You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
We are joined by Michael Swanson from the University of Otago's Politics Department. Michael has recently finished his PhD, and he's here to talk about the politics of fuel prices here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and the broader debate as well. Good morning to you, Michael. How are we?
Oh, I'm good, Zach. How are you?
I am having a really fun morning. I'm looking forward to Easter break.
I think we all are.
I think everyone wants
a wee break. I think everyone is.
Yeah. What are your current Easter break plans?
I am doing a whole lot of not a lot. The point is to take a few days off, so I think I'll be hopefully getting a little bit of sun, recharging. So fingers crossed the weather stays good.
Fingers crossed, man. Let's start talking turkey, I guess. From my interpretation and my observation of the New Zealand discourse around the illegal US-Israeli invasion of Iran, it seems like most of the media is focusing on things like inflation, mortgages, and property prices, rather than the focus of the civilian cost of war. Is there something that you've noticed, or am I one of one?
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think there's a big reason for that, and it's proximity. You know, it's much harder to sort of put yourself in that situation and in that space for a lot of people, because a lot of people right now are thinking about, well, how is this going to impact my bottom line? How is this going to impact how much I'm spending every week? A lot of people have pretty tight budgets. You know, pretty fixed budgets in a lot of cases. If you think both students and pensioners at either end of the scale, pretty fixed. There's not a lot of movement for change in those budgets. So the media kind of naturally react to that and start to look at those cost of living things rather than what is happening in Iran or what is happening in the Straits of Hormuz or the Persian Gulf. They are focused on kind of the day-to-day for New Zealanders. And so sometimes that proximity has a bit of a disconnect between what matters.
Yeah.
That's not to say that it doesn't matter over there, but people find it a slightly harder thing to kind of gauge how much they should be interested in the things that are over there, so to speak, versus happening right here.
I can definitely sympathise with that. But it does kind of make me a bit cynical that people aren't super invested in the war's toll.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's not to say, and to be fair, there are still a huge chunk of the population who do care.
For sure.
And who are interested and engaged. So there's a tension there for the media as well. How much do we keep focusing on what's happening right here in New Zealand versus what's happening in Iran and the broader Middle East? Because I think there's still a detachment from how far reaching that will be for us over here. So it's that kind of issue of what's happening right here to your weekly costs versus actually what's happening over there is hugely important to the flow onto that, and you should care about what is happening, why it's happening, who's doing these things, because sooner or later it will impact you.
On Monday, there was a scuffle between Judith Collins and ACT MP Todd Stevenson as he warned National that the ACT Party was concerned that New Zealand First's English First policy wasn't being taken seriously, to which Collins replied, a fuel crisis is more important than a style guide. As the cost of living, as a flow and effect of this war ramps up, will culture war topics take a back seat in the political discourse, do you reckon?
I think in a broad sense, yes. But you are still going to see that particularly the likes of New Zealand First and ACT focus on some of those issues to a degree, because what they are trying to target is not the 75% of the population that are going, well, actually, we care about good hospitals, good schools, good transport, you know, those kinds of things. They are targeting anywhere from 5 to 20% of the population, depending on the day and the issue, who are in those kind of camps where that is actually a big thing in their own heads. So they are not out there to win 50% of the vote. That is not their focus. Their focus is to get from 5 to 10 or from 10 to 15%. So it makes more sense that they are the ones trying to talk about those things, whereas Judith Collins is saying, no, people don't care about that. Because National aren't looking to win an extra, well, they are looking to win an extra 2%.
No, they might want to.
But they are looking at winning 30, 35% of the vote. That's their focus. So they're going, what are those bigger issues? Whereas ACT and New Zealand First are going, what's going to get us from 10 to 12%?
Mm. It's interesting. Very interesting, though, because this was a New Zealand First policy, the English First policy. And even Shane Jones is saying, no, we need to focus on the fuel crisis. It's ACT who are like, oh, we want to be, you know.
Yeah, ACT have been a funny one because I think they've been beaten to the punch a bit by New Zealand First.
Mm.
New Zealand First kind of cracked on with a few of these culture war kind of policies, and ACT have been almost left to fight for the crumbs in that space.
Mm.
And so you can see this work from Todd Stevenson, who's been particularly noisy lately. You know, he did a lot of the stuff around culture training for Defence Force, and now English language or English First policy work around government. So it's almost a bit of a catch-up thing for ACT. They're really behind the eight ball when it comes to some of this stuff because New Zealand First did it first.
Yeah.
And they're going, oh, hell. So now they're trying to compete with that same space. So really what you're seeing is New Zealand First and ACT competing for a similar up to 20% of the voting base.
Yeah.
And it's where they're going to fit within that. And so it's less of a fight between ACT saying National aren't doing these things. It's more ACT realising that New Zealand First already have and they need to win some votes back.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the election time. The government's planned billion-dollar liquid natural gas terminal in Taranaki has been thrown into scepticism this week as the liquid natural gas prices have risen 143% in Asia since the end of February. The CEOs of Meridian and Genesis said that this makes the terminal pretty untenable. Luxon has said it'll go ahead depending on the business case, and Simon Watts, the energy minister, has expressed confidence in the proposal, and this is all according to RNZ. With its economic viability in question, do you think its political viability will also go into question?
I think so. I think there's big questions already. You know, there were already questions around whether it was viable before this really kicked off. You know, there's a lot of, you know, discussion around whether $7 billion to be spent on a terminal for LNG was the correct way forward to begin with. So now saying that it is that for something that has skyrocketed in price is even more of a really touchy subject. And National have kind of only got themselves to blame on this. They had opportunities to look at different options. You know, what could you do with $7 billion in terms of putting solar panels on every residential property in the country? You know, that kind of thing. And what we're seeing, particularly from the two major parties, you know, Labor isn't out of this discussion either, is a sort of a lack of real future thinking.
Like a vision.
Yeah, it's not. Neither party is really keen to push the boat out when it comes to actually what does this country look like? What does our energy future look like in 30 years' time?
Mm.
What does our energy supply lines look like in 10 years' time? And this is that thing. You know, is $7 billion really best spent on an LNG terminal? I don't think many energy experts in the country or globally would have said that that is the best use of finite resources.
Yeah, and we have a natural abundance of ocean energy, wind energy.
Yep.
We don't get heaps of sun, but it's best to try those things.
We get more than I think people understand. Yeah, I think there's a real there's been a real lack at that government level of sort of a impetus to diversify our natural energy resources.
Mm.
So looking at those renewable resources, we've been very focused on it's either wind or solar or hydro and that's it. There's so much more we could be doing, and $7 billion is a lot of moolah to actually get that done.
Completely.
Yeah.
Knowing how how our big projects work, though, it'll filter down pretty to something very peddly.
Yeah, you can imagine that.
They'll find somewhere to screw it up.
There'll be some way that it ends up being a 15-year development that is then obsolete.
Yeah.
So
yeah. The government seems to be focusing on in the short term increasing supply for our fuel rather than managing it. It's been offered a tempting deal from an unknown commercial operator to purchase nearly a billion litres of fuel, which should arrive in 45 days, according to Shane Jones. Labour leader Chris Hipkins thinks we should also focus on supply right now too. Meanwhile, other countries in the Indo-Southeast Asia kind of area are having public holidays. They're keeping government workers at home. They're rationing fuel. Why is increasing the fuel supply in New Zealand the most palatable option right now? Is it because we're afraid of big government interference like we saw with COVID?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest issues was the timing of the recent phase two COVID report, because what you saw in the wake of that was a sort of a social media onslaught from the coalition parties saying Labour did this, and it was all Labour did too much. Labour was too involved. Labour gave out too much money. They do it just, you know, spraying the cash around. They don't want to be seen to be doing that, because straight away the people turn around and say, well, you're a hypocrite. You just said that Labour did that last time and it was bad. Why are you doing it now? So the solution for them to say is, well, let the market work this out. Mm. Let the market sort of deal with how it deals with these sorts of things. If there are private suppliers or private providers that can boost our supply, that's a great thing for us. So there's an element of reticence to get involved too deeply because of that. The other part of it, I think, is that a lot of voters in that space are looking at the petrol pump prices. So they are going, you know, if you're a tradie, if you're a farmer, if you're, in whatever sort of space, if, you know, you're in transport, you are looking at petrol pump prices, or diesel prices is a really, really big one. And so they'll be sitting there going, well, actually, the best way to relieve the pressure on this is to get more. And so they are looking at it from a less of a, what are these other sorts of things that we could do to the people who we really want to be placating and playing ball with are people who care about the price of petrol no matter what else we do.
Yeah, it's just interesting that even Chris Hipkins is on board with the supply, and they're not even looking at some of the more, you know, resource management policies.
Yeah.
Instead it's just, yeah, buy more fuel.
So from a Labour perspective, they've got the problem of, well, we can't come out and do the COVID playbook of stay at home, don't do these things, you know, because we've just been told that that wasn't liked by a bunch of people. And it might be the people that could get us into government in the next, you know, it's those people in the middle who are sitting there going, oh, I don't really like being told to stay at home. They might be the ones that get us from 35 to 40%. In polls, in the election in November. So you've got that problem for Labour of, we've just been rapped on the knuckles for doing things. Do we really want to step out and say, you know what, that was all good. We knew we were doing a good thing. Because the people who agree with that perspective of what they did during COVID was a good thing are already probably going to vote Labour.
This is true. But I think it speaks again to this this lack of vision. I mean, not only are fuel prices increasing, but I think the Strait of Hormuz handles a whole lot of really key goods for Asia. So much fertilizer comes through the Strait of Hormuz. And so that's going to have a huge flow-on effect. Should Labour not consider more stronger policies to maybe increase their voter base? Because no matter what National Party do at the moment, if they're not doing that, they're going to see fuel prices rise and food costs rise.
At the risk of riling a few people up, I think Labour should consider some policies, full stop.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the biggest problems at the moment is that they have been too silent. So one of my big research areas was around the function of opposition. My thesis is on opposition in Parliament. And one of the big, there are two really big functions of opposition. One is to scrutinise and hold governments to account. The other is to provide an alternative pathway. What they could have done in this sort of situation is actually come out with, you know, a 3 or a 5 or a 7 point plan of these are the things we would do.
Mm-hmm.
And we just haven't seen that. We've sort of left this kind of airspace for the governing parties, the coalition, to kind of have control of the narrative around what's going on and how you should play this and who should do what and where and when and what the way forward is, rather than them actually going, you know what, if we were there, these are the 5 points that we would be focusing on. This is what we would do. This is how we would do it. And this is, you know, the ballpark cost. One of their big arguments from Labor at the moment is they want to wait till the budget at the end of May, almost 2 months.
That's a while.
Before they really do any nitty-gritty policies, because they don't want to get caught out on costings.
No, but it's like they're so caught.
Exactly.
Just so embrace this, just take a stance.
All they have to do is say, here are the things. We need to work with the government on certain bits of it because we don't know the depth of the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But they could just come out with some ideas. You know, some high-level kind of, these are the things we would focus on and how we would go about it. But we're just not seeing that.
Yeah.
The Greens, we've seen it from.
Yep.
The Greens were very quick.
Yeah.
And that's, you're kind of sitting there going, why can't Labor do that? Or why weren't Labor working closely with the Greens? The Greens obviously had ideas and just went for it, which is great. You know, good on them for that.
Mm-hmm.
But Labor almost, you know, they just almost don't want to be involved.
No, it seems quite feeble. I mean, the headline I saw, Chris Hipkins said, I guess I agree with the government supply.
Yeah.
And that's just such a defeatist response.
Yeah.
I want to talk about foreign policy now, because the government has been hesitant to blame this illegal war on the US and Israelis, who are undeniably the initiators. When the two invaded Iran, Chris Luxon, our Prime Minister, routinely said that the US and Israel have their own intel, so it's not up to us to investigate why they started the conflict. The message is that it's not our business, really. Is this a costly political position to maintain? Because I think for people who've been keeping track of world politics, it's pretty obvious that Israel's behind the wheel here.
Yeah, I think they have decided that almost saying nothing is better than saying something, whichever way it is. They've kind of implicitly, and in fact sometimes explicitly, sort of jumped in behind the at least US perspective on things. The weirdest one was the letter to Iran over the closing of the Straits of Hormuz, where it was effectively, don't do this, you're doing a bad thing, from now over 30 countries, without actually identifying why it was closed in the first
place.
Exactly. So you've got this problem here. In terms of the electoral sort of aspect of foreign policy and taking a certain stance, I don't think it would hurt them to sort of to come out and say, this is an illegal war. It was started by Israel and the US. Iran have defended or pushed back. Those are the facts. That's what happened. It's not going to ruffle feathers at home, especially amongst voters, to say that. One of the things we do know, however, is that foreign policy almost never features as a major swing of votes in elections.
You don't think it could be like in the 80s with South Africa?
It's one of those things that it very rarely moves the dial. Because at the end of the day, it's those big things. Now, they might be influenced by foreign policy, some of those issues, but it's the economy, it's health, it's education, kind of usually the big ticket items. Now, we've already talked a lot about how that is heavily influenced by foreign policy, but people want to know how it impacts them at that kind of day-to-day level. And that's not saying that people don't care about the foreign policy issues, but the thing that matters to them is their day-to-day life.
Yeah.
So I don't think it would hurt them, but I don't think taking a firm stance on anything is something that they've identified as a really big factor for them winning votes at the election.
Do you think that it could make them seem weak and uncritical, and that could have an effect on voters in any kind of capacity?
Potentially, although if you think about where a lot of the voters who are looking for them to take a stance on this are probably not naturally aligned
their
with the coalition
anyway.
Parties anyway.
Yeah.
However, you know, it's one of those things. I don't think it would hurt National to actually step out from the crowd. Because I think the biggest risk for National in all of this is being lost in the noise of ACT and New Zealand First. So this might actually be a way for them to not necessarily differentiate, but have a quite a distinct voice from those other two parties and say, you know what, we do actually think this, and we do think this is a bad thing. You know, that is not going to hurt them in terms of that. In fact, it might help within that kind of melting pot of the coalition side of the vote.
Well, there's been a really, really enlightening and fun with inverted commas. It's been a really, really enlightening chat. Thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks, Zach.
Thank you. That was Michael Swanson from the University of Otago Politics Department talking to me about New Zealand's response to rising fuel prices and our internal politics. Here is Homebrew with...
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.